the world is learning to know that there is a spiritual law that can safeguard mankind from the violent forces of nature, from death-dealing disease, from impairing accidents, from the corrosive action of matter, even from nuclear holocaust. The Bible, from Genesis to Revelation, is filled with evidence of God's omnipotence, of His unchanging infinite good, of His tender care for man, and of His divine law of protection. Mary Baker Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, has written, "The history of Christianity furnishes the blind proof of the supporting influence and protecting power bestowed on man by His Heavenly Father's omnipotent mind, who gives man faith and understanding whereby to defend himself not only from temptation, but from bodily suffering." This afternoon, I'd like to share with you some experiences of my own that have been proofs to me of God's supporting influence and protecting power, proofs that can bring comfort, quiet fear, silent doubt, and answer some of the questions arising in our hearts and minds. But beyond this, I pray that these contemporary proofs will serve to illustrate to you that God's power is as effective today as it has been throughout the history of Christianity to bestow on mankind, on you and on me, protection as a result of spiritual faith and understanding. The first question that we might ask is, can man's life be protected from the destructive forces of nature through spiritual faith and understanding? To answer this question, I'd like to share with you an experience that my family and I had when we were sailing in the Bahamas. One evening, the radio crackled with an urgent message for us. "Return at once to the Florida coast. An emergency." We left port around midnight and entered an area called the Tongue of the Ocean and sailed due north. About 3 a.m. in the morning, I noticed mushrooming signals appearing all over the radar screen, indicating storms beginning to surround us. By this time, we had reached Great Isaac's Light and were sailing due west to Cat Key, over an area challenging at its best in full sunlight, largely due to great variations in depth and coral heads not far below the surface of the water. I'm sure that many of you are well aware of the superstitious fear regarding another area of the ocean known as the Bermuda Triangle, where many boats have disappeared, leaving no trace at all. This was similar territory, fraught with danger to craft in any kind of storm. For a while, we were able to avoid the storms as they broke, but we were becoming rapidly aware that multiple electrical explosions were beginning to surround us. My husband, who had been examining the radar screen intently, suddenly shouted, "We won't be able to miss this one. We'll have to ride right through it." It was as though all hell had broken loose. Dreaded white water was on every side, pouring over the gunwales. The wind was fierce. The waves were mounting higher and higher, and rain was falling in torrents. Bolts of lightning were shafting into the water as close as 10 feet on either side of us. The heat and pulse from them threw us both to the deck. I peered out on the aft deck. Everything was awash, slamming from port to starboard, from aft to forward. We were pitching, rolling, plunging through the waves. In all this threat of sinking, I suddenly remembered Noah and his ark. And I cried out, "We have an ark. We are safe. God is ever present, right here, completely surrounding us. No force of nature can destroy us." You will remember that the very first account of God's protecting power in the Bible is in Genesis chapters 6 through 9. It is the account of Noah and the great flood. At that time, the Bible tells us that the earth was corrupt before God and filled with violence. Why did Noah win the grace of God? Because, according to the Bible, Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. His lawfulness, his morality, and his obedience won him God's protective care. And the Bible tells us that Noah walked and talked with God. God made a covenant with Noah and instructed him to build an ark into which he was to bring every member of his family and a pair of every living creature. Noah was obedient, and he built his ark. The floods came and inundated the earth and submerged everything, but the ark floated above the flood. Sometime later, the waters began to abate, and a white winged dove flew forth from the ark and returned with an olive leaf in her beak. At this sign, Noah knew that it was safe for his family and every creature to go forth from the ark. And God sealed his covenant with Noah by a bow upon a cloud, a radiant rainbow, a token, the Bible tells us, of God's covenant of protection for all flesh upon the earth for perpetual generations. Everybody tells us in Science and Health, the key to the scriptures, that the ark signifies safety. I saw that we need not fear destruction. I saw that we could turn to God in prayer and receive his unwavering, faultless guidance and experience his calm. I also remembered the account of Jesus when he was sailing with his disciples in their fishing boat on the stormy Galilean Sea. The account is in Matthew, and according to it, the Master was asleep in the hold of the boat. But his disciples, fearful at the mounting storm, cried out, "Master, save us, we perish." And the Master arose, and addressing his disciples, said, "O, why are ye fearful, O ye of little faith?" And then he turned and rebuked the wind and the waves, and there was a great calm. Christ Jesus mastered the violent forces of nature through his spiritual faith and understanding. Wind, wave, and tempest could not destroy his complete confidence in God's protecting power, and I saw they could not destroy ours. Just as suddenly as the fierce storm had hit us, it left us. The sea quieted. Checking our course on the compass, we found we had not varied a single degree, nor had the tides carried us off. Dawn was glowing pink in the east behind us, and dead ahead lay Cat-Key Light. Over it arched a bow upon a cloud, a radiant rainbow emblazoned on the waking morning, reaching from the horizon on the north to the still purple depths of the water to the south. We proceeded swiftly and safely to our destination and were able to respond to the urgent call for help with joy, deeply mindful of our gratitude for that call, which had necessitated our braving a crossing, which shall long be remembered for its glorious proof of God's protecting power. What was this power that was greater than the violent forces of nature, that had safeguarded Noah and his ark, that had stilled the tempest before the Master's rebuke, and that had brought us safely to shore? It was God, omnipotent, infinite life, the same protecting power that protects all mankind and you and me today. Man does not have to live under the threat and whim of the violent forces of nature. Man can turn to God in prayer and receive his unwavering, faultless guidance and experience his calm. As you and I grow in the awareness that the violent forces of nature do not constitute the true laws of nature, you will also grow in the understanding that the true laws of nature are constituted of the spiritual forces of God's infinite life, and that these spiritual forces, these spiritual laws, do indeed bring the harmony of heaven to earth and maintain man forever safe in his spiritual ark of safety. The next question that we might ask is, can man's life be protected from death-dealing disease through spiritual faith and understanding? To answer this question, I'd like to tell you about a healing I had many years ago. My body suddenly developed a large and unsightly tumor. I had to compensate for it by adjusting my clothing, and it made me sick and fearful at heart. One afternoon, when I was driving into town, I passed the largest outdoor advertising billboard in the city. It was solid black, except for a bright red crab down in the lower left-hand corner. By the time I'd gotten 2 blocks beyond the billboard, my hands were wet and cold with fear. My knees were shaking, and my feet were cold. I had recognized the bright red crab as the insignia of the Cancer Fund Crusade. Of course it was the fear of cancer that had lain back in my thoughts. I had diagnosed my case in the terms of malignity and possible impending death, and it had brought terror to my thinking. When I reached home, I turned to my Bible, a copy of the King James Version, for comfort, and I studied every account of Jesus' healings in the New Testament. As I did so, I began to glimpse something of Jesus' healing method, and it brought much comfort to my thinking, and the fear began to lessen. I then turned to the Christian Science textbook to study everything that Mrs. Eddy had to say on Jesus' healing method. Among the citations which I found helpful were the following. Jesus never spoke of disease as dangerous or as difficult to heal. He never described disease, so far as can be learned from the gospel, but he healed disease. He prescribed no drugs, urged no obedience to material laws, but acted in direct disobedience to them. Jesus never taught that drugs, food, air, and exercise could make a man healthy, or that they could destroy human life, nor did he illustrate these errors by his practice. Jesus never asked if disease were acute or chronic, and he never recommended attention to laws of health, never gave drugs, never prayed to know if God were willing that a man should live. What did the Master do? According to the Bible, he prayed. He denied the inevitability of death, and he saw death as an enemy to be overcome. Jesus knew that God, omnipresent, omnipotent divine love, was the only cause and creator of the universe and man. And Jesus knew that divine love made man in his image and likeness, and gave him the gift of dominion. Sin, disease, and death never intimidated the Master. Death neither impressed him nor depressed him. Jesus knew that God, omnipresent, omnipotent divine love, conferred on man perfection, continuity, and immortality. And he knew that man, as a beloved child of God, was never held in jeopardy, but was forever held safe in God's protecting power. The healing that I had read in the New Testament that meant the most to me at this time was the healing of Jairus' daughter. You will remember that Jairus was the ruler of the synagogue house, and that he had a lovely child who lay perilously close to death. He had gone to seek the Master's help on her behalf. But before he reached the Master, his servants caught up with him and said, "Trouble not the Master. Thy daughter is dead." Jesus overheard this pronouncement, and turning to Jairus, he said, "Fear not. She is not dead, but sleepeth. Believe only, and she shall be made whole." And then he took Jairus and the mother of the maiden, and 3 of his most trusted disciples, Peter, James, and John, and went to Jairus' house and entered into the chamber of the maiden. According to the account in Luke, at what they saw, they all wept and bewailed her. And the master turned to them and said, "Weep not, she is not dead, but sleeping." And they all laughed him to scorn, knowing that she was dead. And what did the master do? He put them all out. And turning to the maiden, he said, "Maid, arise." And the account tells us that her spirit came again unto her, and she arose, and he commanded to give her meat. I saw from that evening that I had much that I had to put all out. I had to put all out anything in my thinking that wept over the condition. I had to put all out of my thinking anything that bewailed the challenge I was facing. And I had to put all out of my consciousness everything in it that laughed to scorn the hidden efficacy of the Christ or doubted its ultimate victory. On the basis of that healing, I made a compact with myself that I would never again look at the tumor. I would not touch it. I would not feel it. I would not probe it. I would not wish to see what new forms it was assuming. I would turn totally from it. And I made a further compact with myself that any time that I felt the mesmeric urgency drawing my attention to the tumor and suggesting to me that I must examine it, that I would turn totally from it because I knew that to examine matters would only make me more fearful of it. I can remember one afternoon walking up and down in the apartment, reading out loud from the Christian Science textbook and from the Bible. I had promised myself that if ever I had that magnetic urgency drawing me to the tumor again, I would read from one of those two volumes until I put down and out the temptation to examine the body. For 4.5 hours, I read out loud from the Christian Science textbook, and I won that hour of challenge. The next day, I found another passage in one of Mrs. Eddy's volumes entitled Unity of Good in her prose works, where she writes, "This false sense of substance must yield to his eternal presence and so dissolve." And I recognized that the only legitimate diagnosis of this condition was a false sense of substance. That's all it was. And Mrs. Eddy had placed upon it a spiritual demand. It must yield to his eternal presence. She did not say it might, or it should, or it could, or it may, or it would. She said it must yield to his eternal presence. And she even told me how it would go. She said, "Dissolve." I then remembered another passage in Science and Health, where Mrs. Eddy says on page 242 that divine love is the universal solvent which dissolves the adamant of error. And I was led to look up in Webster's unabridged dictionary his definition of the word adamant. The primary definition is an imaginary stone of impenetrable hardness. And I said to myself, how can an imaginary stone be impenetrably hard? That which is imaginary is only the figment of the imagination. And I began to recognize that through divine love, the universal solvent of error, that no stubborn, rebellious, disobedient growth could withstand the dissolving power of love. I also found another statement which was useful to me. It was on page 412 of the textbook, and there Mrs. Eddy writes, "Realize the presence of health and the fact of harmonious being until the body corresponds with the normal condition of health and harmony." And I asked myself, How long must I realize the presence of health and the fact of harmonious being? And I found the answer within the sentence. Until the body corresponds with the normal condition of health and harmony. And I realized that I must indeed persist in knowing the presence of health and the fact of harmonious being until the body corresponded with the normal conditions of health and harmony. Sometime later, I was aware that my clothing was hanging loosely. The tumor had dissolved. My flesh was fresh, fair, and healthy. I was healed, and I had also recognized that the only true growth man could have was the growth in spiritual faith and understanding. That healing occurred over 40 years ago, and I've never seen a trace nor a vestige of the tumor's growth since that time. I have seen other tumors healed through Christian Science. Tumors are false growths. Webster defines a tumor in the following way: an abnormal mass of tissue, arising without obvious cause, possessing no physiological function, and unrestrained in growth and structure. That which is abnormal must be illegitimate. That which arises without cause must be without effect. That which possesses no function must be extraneous, useless, unnecessary. And that which is unrestrained in growth and structure must be without basis or foundation. The secretion and accretion of matter is never true growth. True growth must always be orderly and normal in development. True growth contains no rebellious, disobedient, insubordinate aspect of growth. And true growth is regulated by God, omnipresent, omnipotent, divine love. True growth maintains man's being in perfect health and abundant well-being. Man is never the victim of malignant, death-dealing disease, for God, omnipotent, omnipresent divine love, confers on man perfection, continuity, and immortality. The next question that we might ask is, can man's life be protected from impairing accident through spiritual faith and understanding? To answer this question, I'd like to share with you an experience that my husband and I had one evening when we were driving out from New York City to our home in Westchester County on the West Side Highway. I'm sure many of you are well acquainted with that particular highway. It has three channels that run north and three which flow south. And at the time of peak traffic, those channels are completely filled with fast-moving vehicles. As we came up over a rise in the road, we saw that the two cars immediately in front of us had collided. There was no way for us to turn out, either to the left or to the right. My husband was able to stop our car within inches of the second car. But a heavy van, coming up over the rise immediately behind us, slammed into us and telescoped us into the rear of the second car. I was thrown with such force beneath the dashboard of our car that I lost consciousness. My husband told me sometime later that he was able to extricate himself from his side of the car, come around, wrench open the door on my side, and lift me gently up on the front seat. As I began to regain consciousness, I was aware that he was repeating a passage from page 424 of the Christian Science textbook. He was saying, accidents are unknown to God or in mortal mind, and we must leave the mortal basis of belief and unite with the one mind in order to change the notion of chance to the proper sense of God's unerring direction and thus bring out harmony. On the basis of that passage, we reasoned that since accidents are unknown to God or in mortal mind, they must be unknown to man the image and likeness of the mortal mind. We realize, of course, that we must leave the mortal basis of belief and unite with the one mind in order to change the notion of chance and to bring out the proper sense of God's unerring direction. Man does not have to exist under the notion of chance, fatality, or destruction. Man exists under the solid fact of God's unerring, perfect direction. And we knew that as we maintained these spiritual laws, that we would indeed see harmony brought out and established. After the police finished making their report, they told us that we could proceed home. We did so, but very slowly, because our car was badly out of alignment. But we sang hymns from the Christian Science hymnal all the way, knowing that their messages of joy and comfort would still the sense of shock. When I reached home and prepared to retire for the evening, I was aware that my body had sustained multiple injuries. My flesh was rapidly darkening from many bruises. My right arm was hanging limply at my side out of its socket. My collarbone gave evidence of fracture or splinting. But the greatest challenge was with my head. I kept fading in and out of consciousness, and my vision was badly blurred. All through the night, we prayed off and on. The next day at luncheon, when I was sitting with my two daughters, I was aware that everything I looked at, I was seeing in triplicate. It made me nauseous and very afraid. I excused myself, went to my room, closed the door, and sat down to pray. And I picked up my Bible and the Christian Science textbook, but I could not distinguish a single word on the page. I sat there all through the long afternoon, recalling everything I had ever committed to thought from those two beloved volumes, and their messages brought comfort to me. As the afternoon wore on, I was aware of the gradual darkening of the day, and I glanced down at the volume that was open in my lap and found, to my delight, that I could at last read a word at a time. I was focused on page 79 of Miscellaneous Writing in our leader's prose works, and there she writes, "In Him we live, move, and have being. Man's origin and existence being in Him, man is the ultimatum of perfection and by no means the medium of imperfection. Immortal man is the eternal idea of truth that cannot lapse into a mortal belief or error concerning himself or his origin. He cannot get out of the focal distance of infinity." On the basis of that passage, I reason that in Him, in God, I did indeed live, move, and have my being. And I declared that since man's origin and existence are in Him, in God, I could assert that I, as the image and likeness of God, was indeed the ultimatum of perfection. An ultimatum brooks no insubordination, no rebellion to its law. And I could declare further that I could not be the medium of imperfection. I could not have imperfect vision. I could not have impaired sight. And I declared that as immortal man, I was indeed the idea of truth of God, and that I could not lapse into unconsciousness. I could not lapse into nor out of consciousness. God is conscious of man, and man is conscious of God. And then I came to that glorious portion of the statement where she says that man cannot get out of the focal distance of infinity. And I said to myself, what is the focal distance of infinity? And I remembered a question in Jeremiah. Am I a God at hand, saith the Lord, and not a God afar? And I saw that there could not be near nor far to God's focal distance of infinity. his focal distance of infinity had to be all-encompassing. If I could see close at hand, I had to be able to see afar off. And if I could see afar off, I had to be able to see close at hand. Because, as the immortal idea of immortal truth God, I had to express perfect vision, perfect sight, because I could not be the medium of imperfection. I was indeed the ultimatum of perfection. The next day, we went to church. I'd been able to use my right arm to put up my long hair. My collarbone no longer gave evidence of fracture or splintering, and the bruises were rapidly fading from my flesh. When I reached church, to my delight, everything I read, I saw with brilliant clarity and glorious illumination. Prior to this experience, I'd been having a very severe challenge with my vision. I had been well aware that I had been making serious discrepancies in my reading, and it had saddened me. But on this morning, I saw everything with glorious clarity and brilliant illumination, and I have never since that time had a similar challenge with my vision. I have proven to a degree that no impact of matter could impair man's structure, and that no impact of matter could injure or disturb man's soul-derived faculties of spiritual sense. Paul had a glorious proof that no impact of matter could destroy man's structure or deprive him of life. You will remember, according to the account in Acts, that Paul had been long speaking, even up until midnight. And sitting up in the third loft on the windowsill was a young man by the name of Eutychus, who had been struggling with sleep as he endeavored to listen to Paul's lengthy dissertation. According to the account in Acts, Eutychus fell down heavy with slumber from the third loft, and those who rushed to his side picked him up as one dead. Eutychus saw this, and he went down, and Paul saw this, and he went down and embraced Eutychus. And he said to those assembled, "Trouble not yourselves. His life is in him." Paul did not mean that Eutychus' life was in Eutychus' mortal body. He was saying, with the same spiritual perceptivity that Mrs. Eddy had declared in Miscellaneous Writings on page 79, that in him we live, move, and have being. Now, Jesus, in his healing ministry, had many proofs, too, of the effectiveness of the Christ truth to restore man's soul-derived faculties of spiritual sense. Just as Paul had been able to restore Eutychus to life, and those who had gathered round were no longer troubled, but rejoiced greatly in that proof, that no impact of matter could destroy man's life or injure his structure. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are filled with evidence of Jesus' ability to demonstrate the healing Christ, to restore man's God's soul-derived faculties of spiritual sense to perfect function and operation. You will remember he was enabled to have the dumb to speak, the deaf to hear, the blind to see. And one account even says that he was enabled to loose the string of the tied tongue. The words Christ and Jesus are often used interchangeably, but shouldn't we, oughtn't we, to use the word Christ to signify Jesus' spiritual sonship, his divine healing authority of the Christ truth to restore man's faculties to perfect function and operation. The Christ truth, which was so evident almost 2,000 years ago in Jesus' healing ministry, is as evident today and is available today through Christian science to restore man's soul-derived faculties of spiritual sense to perfect function and operation. Mrs. Eddy defines the Christ in the chapter of the Glossary in Science and Health in the following way. She says that Christ is the divine manifestation of God, which comes to the flesh to destroy incarnate error. The Christ does indeed come to the flesh, fulfilling Job's promise, "Yet in my flesh shall I see God." The Christ comes to the flesh to feed and supply, to correct and instruct, to guide and to protect. And the Christ truth does indeed protect man from impairing accident. Man's structure cannot be injured nor destroyed, and man's soul-derived faculties of spiritual sense cannot be impaired or disturbed by any impact of matter. The next question that we might ask is, can man's life be protected from the corrosive action of matter through spiritual faith and understanding? To answer this question, I'd like to share with you an experience I had when I was in college. I was taking a course in chemistry, and I was working in a chemistry laboratory that was so constructed that it had two sinks on either side, two desks on either side of a shared sink. The morning of which I speak, we were conducting an experiment with concentrated sulfuric acid heated to the boiling point. The professor had come to my desk to grade my laboratory manual and to see how I had conducted the experiment. As he was doing this, I turned to empty the contents of my test tube into the sink at my right. The student on the other side of the sink, not seeing what I was doing, poured the contents of her test tube over my right hand. The pain and heat were unbelievable, almost unbearable. I realized that as I stood there at the sink, that I had to rise to the point of spiritual conviction immediately. And I also had to put out of my thoughts the recollection of a similar accident which had occurred just the previous year in the same chemistry laboratory with the same chemical experiment which had occurred to a precious friend of mine. I was well aware from his experience that, according to physical law, that chemical could quickly eat away the flesh to the bone. The professor seized my hand and wanted to pour a basic solution over it in an attempt to counteract the action of the acid. But I said, "Please, don't do that. I wanted to rely fully and completely on the spiritual laws that I had learned in Christian Science in this hour of challenge." And I said to him, "Please, I need to be alone for a few moments." And then he stated that according to his professional ethics, he had to report that accident immediately to the college authorities. But he said, "I will give you a few moments." And he took me to his office, closed the door, and left me. I turned to God in prayer, and the first thought that came to me was from Proverbs, where it is written, "The substance of a diligent man is precious." And I said, "Thank you, God. Of course my substance is precious to you, cherished and esteemed by you. But I must be a diligent man. I must rely radically on the spiritual laws that I know through Christian Science." And then my thought turned to another passage from Psalms, two verses that I had learned in the Christian Science Sunday School. Let me read them to you. "My substance was not hid from thee. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect. And in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned." And I said, "Of course, God, my substance is not hid from you. Your eyes do indeed behold my substance. And in thy book all my members are written, for you have fashioned them in continuance." And then I recall the passage from Science and Health on page 468, where Mrs. Eddy says, "Substance is that which is eternal and incapable of discord and decay." And I affirmed that my substance is indeed eternal and incapable of discord and decay. My substance is constituted of the very essence of Spirit God. My substance is indeed the substance of spirit. It is wholly spiritual and not material. I am not a physiological structure. I am not a chemical compound. I am the compound spiritual idea of infinite spirit God. And no corrosive, corroding action of matter can in any way dissolve or destroy the substance of my being. At that point, I remembered the account in Daniel of the three Hebrew boys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You will remember they were citizens in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. And Nebuchadnezzar had built a golden, horrendous image. And by royal fiat and dictate had decreed that every citizen in his country must indeed bow down and worship it under penalty of death in the fiery furnace if they deigned not to conform. And the three Hebrew boys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, declared, "The God who can deliver will deliver us from the burning fiery furnace." And they deigned not to conform to Nebuchadnezzar's dictate. And they were thrust into the burning fiery furnace upon the penalty that had been levied against them. And what occurred? They went into the fiery furnace, and Nebuchadnezzar, in great curiosity and great fear, rushed to peer in to see what had occurred. He did not see three men walking, but four. And who or what was the fourth? According to the account in Daniel, the fourth had the face and the form of the Son of God. Was it not the Christ truth that walked with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, just as the Christ truth will walk with you and me today? The account goes on to say that they came forth from their fiery trial. Their hair was not singed, their coat, their hosen, their shoes were not burned, and there was no smell of smoke upon them. And Nebuchadnezzar declared with great humility, "There is no God who can save like the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." At that moment, I saw that I, too, could come forth from my trial with no smell of smoke upon me. And at that moment, the pain and the heat left my body, and I was at peace. And at that moment, the professor came back into his office and demanded, "Lay your hand in mine." And I did so, and he examined it carefully and intently. There was no reddened flesh. There was no dissolving substance. And looking up at me, with tears in his eyes, he said, "You are on holy ground." He did acknowledge to the college authorities the accident, and he also openly affirmed that Christian Science had completely satisfied the corrosive action of the chemical on my flesh. That evening, many years ago, in the chemistry laboratory, is not on the level of nuclear holocaust today, but it does contain a sweet promise for each one of us, because it can assure us that as we marshal the same spiritual facts on our behalf today, that those spiritual laws can constitute curative, preventative, and restorative laws on behalf of mankind in the face of the threat of nuclear holocaust with its nuclear fallout and destructive radiation. This brings me to my fifth and last question. Can man's life be protected from nuclear holocaust through spiritual faith and understanding? And a parallel question. Does mankind today have a choice between holocaust and peace? I'm sure that the hearts and minds of every one of us here today yearns to answer those questions in the affirmative. Let us not be reluctant to face the subject of nuclear energy and atomic action. We will need to think prayerfully, deeply, and metaphysically on this subject. And the way that we do reason prayerfully, deeply, and metaphysically on this subject can do much to lessen the almost universal paralyzing fear in human consciousness today on the subject of nuclear energy and atomic action. You will remember that back in 1945, on August 6th, the first bomb fell on Hiroshima. On August 9th, 3 days later, the second bomb fell on Nagasaki. The world was well aware of the corrosive, corroding, dissolving, destroying power of atomic energy at that time. Approximately 6 weeks later, the University of Chicago convened a two-day seminar on the subject of nuclear energy and atomic action. Somehow, I was included in a guest list that invited only 100 citizens in the city of Chicago to that seminar. I shall always be grateful that I was included, for it has required of me almost daily consideration of the subject of nuclear energy and atomic action since that time. The leading nuclear physicists of America were there: Millikan, Thompson, Urey, Fermi, and Einstein had written a very definitive paper for our perusal and analysis. The focus of their thinking was largely along this line, that every innovative, creative invention, down through the history of mankind, has always had with it a two-horned dilemma. On one side, the threat of peril. On the other side, the promise of hope. And they urged us to be able to prayerfully enlist our thoughts, not on the side of the threat of peril, but on the side of the promise of hope. And they asked us to pray to learn how to properly govern, regulate, and control nuclear energy and atomic action so that they could indeed become a force for the good of mankind. Sometime later, I was teaching a class in a Christian Science Sunday school. It was a college-age class with 11 wonderfully prospective young people in it. And the subject of the lesson that morning was, is the universe, including man, evolved by atomic force? I'm going to digress for a moment, because I want to remind you that back in the 1890s, Mary Baker Eddy had selected 26 lesson topics to be used twice during the year as the basis for our Sunday lesson sermons in our branch churches and in the Mother Church. Think of the far-ranging vision that she had to have selected at that time in the development of human consciousness on this subject, to have picked the topic, is the universe, including man, evolved by atomic force? That morning, I asked the first 10 students, is the universe, including man, evolved by atomic force? And each one of them answered with a firm no. Then I came to the 11th, and I said, is the universe, including man, evolved by atomic force? And looking at me very directly, he said, yes. And I said, why do you say yes? Well, he said, doesn't it depend upon how you define atomic force? This sent us to our book. And the first sentence that we found that was useful was Mrs. Eddy's definition of the word creator, where she says, creator is God who made all that was made and could not create an element or an atom the opposite of himself. And I realized that Mrs. Eddy was saying that God did not create an atom or an element the opposite of himself. She did not say that he did not create an atom or an element. And then we found two more passages in miscellaneous writings which were useful to us. The first one was on page 23 of miscellaneous writings, and there Mrs. Eddy says, the universe, including man, is not a result of atomic action, material force or energy. It is not organized thus. We reason, the universe, including man, is not a result of material atomic action. It is not the result of material force. It is not the result of material energy. It therefore cannot be remanded to material dust. The next citation that we found was on page 190 of miscellaneous writings, and there Mrs. Eddy says, atomic action is mind, not matter. It is neither the energy of matter, the result of organization, nor the outcome of life infused into matter. It is the infinite spirit, truth, life, defiant of error or matter. Let me read that to you again. Atomic action, she says, is mind, and she capitalizes the word mind, signifying God. Atomic action is mind, not matter. It is neither the energy of matter, the result of organization, nor the outcome of life infused into matter. It is the infinite spirit, truth, life, defiant of error or matter. On the basis of Mrs. Eddy's revolutionary definitions of atomic action as mind, as spirit, truth, and life, I would like to say to you that Mrs. Eddy stands preeminent among men, not as a material physicist, but as a consummate spiritual scientist. Mary Baker Eddy is the discoverer, founder, and leader of Christian Science. As the discoverer, she spent long years in theological study and religious pursuit, which brought her to the summit of spiritual receptivity for the reception and the recognition of the science of the Christ. She continued deep, prayerful, biblical research and was enabled to give to the world the spiritual rule, the healing method, and the moral ethics of the science of the Christ. She named her discovery Christian Science. As the founder of Christian Science, Mary Baker Eddy spent over 40 years doing the first healing and the first teaching. She authored the Christian Science textbook, Science and Health Were Key to the Scriptures, which she published in 1875. She founded her church, the Mother Church, the First Church of Christ Science in Boston, Massachusetts, and its world-encircling system of branch churches. She also authored its system of government by writing the church manual, which contains the rules and bylaws of the Mother Church. And she says of the manual that it is for the defense and dignity of the cause, and that its simple requirements are essential to demonstrate genuine Christian science. She established every aspect of the healing, teaching, and preaching mission of Christian Science. As the leader of Christian Science, she won universal acclaim, worldwide acceptance, and affection. Among the many honors conferred on her were sponsorship of the Association of International Conciliation and a lifetime membership in the prestigious Philosophical Society of Great Britain, known as the Victoria Institute, which included in its membership theological bishops, profound philosophers, and brilliant scholars. Mary Baker Eddy stands preeminent among men in these times, and she welcomes invention, creativity, and innovation. She welcomed the increase of knowledge along every line, and she recognized that with the increase of spiritual faith and understanding, there would come an augmentation of good that would increase the affluence and the abundance in the human economy that would bless all mankind. I'm going to ask you to come and change this. We are recording this lecture on behalf of Arden Wood today, and I believe the tape is about to run out. Will you wait just a moment? At this point, I'd like to repeat to you my earlier statement that Mary Baker Eddy stands preeminent among men, not as a material physicist, but as a consummate spiritual scientist. Almost 100 years after Mrs. Eddy's revolutionary discovery of the unreality of matter, of the true nature of spiritual substance, and of divine mind's atomic action, a nuclear physicist at Johns Hopkins University by the name of Dr. Donald Andrews wrote in his dissertation entitled A Faith for the Space Age the following: the dominant power of the universe is not the shattering physical power of the atom. It is the power which lies beyond the material atom the power of love. It is this power and this alone which can guard us as we move forward into the awesome new world of atomics and automation, rockets, and space. The physical power of the atom is released by chain reaction. Today, we need a chain reaction of the spirit to release in the world a new power of love. If only a few of us can have this vision and faith, and have it intensely, we can be the torch which will start the chain reaction to ignite men's hearts throughout the world. We can open the doors to a golden future, and as the dawn of that new day brightens, we shall understand at last the meaning of the words, "The truth shall make you free." We can indeed open the doors to a golden future, and we can close the door on the horrendous holocaust of the past. We can comprehend that God is indeed the only cause and creator of the universe and man, and that God has created man in his image and likeness and given him the gift of dominion over all the earth. The answer to the question, can man's life be protected from the destructive forces of nature, from death-dealing malignant disease, from impairing accidents, from the corrosive action of matter, even nuclear holocaust, lies in the following spiritual facts. God, divine mind, does indeed confer on man spiritual faith and understanding, whereby he can defend himself not only from temptations, but from bodily suffering. God, infinite life, constituting the spiritual forces and the divine laws of nature, does indeed protect man from the destructive forces of nature and maintains man forever safe in his ark of spiritual safety. God, omnipresent, omnipotent divine love, constituting the universal solvent for the adamant of error, does indeed dissolve any stubborn, rebellious, insubordinate condition of matter, and man therefore cannot be the victim of death-dealing malignant disease, for divine love confers on man perfection, continuity, and immortality. And the Christ truth, God, does indeed protect man from impairing accidents, for the Christ truth maintains man's structure in perfect alignment, and does indeed protect man's structure from any impairing or destructive impact of matter. And so, God maintains man's spiritual center in perfect function, free from any impairment, disturbance, or limitation. And Spirit, God, constituting the very essence of man's substance, does indeed protect man from the corrosive, corroding action of chemicals, from the dissolving, destroying action of matter, and maintains man's substance forever inviolate and in perfect well-being. And divine principle, God, governing the universe and man, maintains his universe and his beloved child forever under his all-harmonious governing law of love. Christian science has revealed that there is indeed a spiritual law that can safeguard mankind's life. Christ Jesus gave a promise not only to his own disciples, but to his followers for all time, and that promise is recorded in Luke. He writes, "When ye shall hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified. There shall not an hair of your head perish. And when there shall be men's hearts failing them for fear, and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, the powers of heaven shaken, when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh." The promise is, there shall not an hair of your head perish. And over the promise is arched a bow upon a cloud, a radiant rainbow, a token of God's covenant of protection for all flesh upon the earth for perpetual generations. I should like to leave with you a benediction from Mary Baker Eddy. It is from her poem, Love, in the Christian Science Hymnal. 'Twas love whose finger traced aloud a bow of promise on the cloud. Thou to whose power our hope we give, free us from human strife. Fed by thy love, divine we live. For love alone is life, and life most sweet, as heart to heart speak kindly when we meet and part. Thank you for coming, and good afternoon.